One of the big buzzwords this past week has been fracking, since the Trump administration released an environmental review about the possibility of expanding hydraulic fracturing on federal lands in Central California. The feds held three public meetings on it last week, one of which was in Bakersfield. It was attended by FM89 reporter Carrie Klein, who's here to tell us a little more about what this document could mean. So, hey, Carrie.
Hi, Laura.
So, as I mentioned, the administration put out this environmental review. What's in this document?
So the document has a super wonky name. It's called a Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. It's put out by the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. And all that really means is it's a supplement to a 2014 plan. And it came out because there was a lawsuit against that plan. And the way this kind of addresses it is it kind of did a deeper dive into this environmental review. And it says if we open up 1 million acres of federal land in Central California, if we open it up to hydraulic fracturing, there will be no significant environmental impact. So after the meeting, I caught up with Gabe Garcia, who's the field manager for the BLM field office in Bakersfield.
This is a step in the process. You know, it's a 30,000-foot look on it. You know, are there impacts that we can't mitigate for? We haven't seen those yet, but you know, obviously, we're as part of the comment period, we're looking for additional information to see if there are changes that need to be made.
What does this document actually do? Does that mean then that fracking could start happening next week?
No, this is not a regulatory document. It's just an environmental one. And just like any bureaucratic process, there are a whole bunch of steps that would need to happen before fracking could actually start. So the first is that this is only a draft. So Garcia says the BLM will take public comments into account before releasing the final draft, likely in the fall. And then, of course, there's the whole permitting process. There are two steps, apparently, that would involve public comment periods before an oil company could actually acquire land and begin working there. And then they also have to go through any county and statewide regulations. And all of that takes a lot of time.
Tell us more about where this fracking could take place. I mean, what land are we talking about here?
So we're talking about federal land in Central California owned by the BLM, or land that could be owned by someone else, but where BLM has jurisdiction over the subsurface mineral rights. And this is over about 1 million acres in 8 counties. It does not include lands in national parks, national forests, or national monuments, though I should note that there is already some oil and gas development happening in some national monuments. It was grandfathered in. And one thing I don't think that many people know is that there is already a lot of fracking happening in this area, particularly in Kern County. A little over 1,000 wells have been hydraulically fractured in California, either once or multiple times, and another 150 more have been permitted, but work hasn't actually begun yet. So none of that is included in this environmental analysis that only talks about this BLM federal land moving forward.
And earlier you mentioned the review said there would be no significant environmental impacts if they opened up this land. That sounds like a little too good to be true. I mean, did it really not find any impacts?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it acknowledges that there are impacts, or that there could be impacts if they're not mitigated, or some of them are just too insignificant to count. So it acknowledges that there's disruption of the ground. There would be some air emissions. There's a risk of contamination if wastewater isn't disposed of properly. It also acknowledges that there are some tribal assets in all of this, like some sacred sites and the possibility of artifacts being located in some of these areas. But the reason they can say that most of this should be insignificant or easily mitigated is because they're estimating that only about 4 wells per year would be fracked on this federal land. Many feel that that's an underestimate, especially given that there are hundreds being fracked right now currently. But again, Gabe Garcia of the BLM explains that that estimate is based on data. It's based on previous development on federal lands, looking back at a few decades of new lease sales. Here's Garcia again.
And so when we look back, there's not a lot of wells that are drilled from those new leases. Most of the drilling that occurs in our field office areas are on existing leases, leases that have been around for 30 to 70 years in some cases. And so this analysis focuses on those lands that are available but unleased. And so we don't feel that there's going to be a huge rush.
Well, at this public meeting last Tuesday, I understand maybe 150 people showed up. So clearly, I mean, they don't feel assured by this document. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. People are really concerned about a lot of things. The big picture about climate change, but also really the health of their communities. And so these people came from all over the Central Valley, you know, from at least as far north as Merced is who I saw, and then all over Kern County, things like that. You know, and they really want to protect water. They want to protect, you know, air quality in the environment. And so here here's someone I spoke with named Saul Ruiz Martinez. He's a resident of Lost Hills. It's a small community adjacent to a ton of Kern County oil fields, lots of oil wells. He's the president of the Lost Hills Action Committee. He's speaking in Spanish, and I'll come in and explain what he says afterwards.
Me molesta que contaminan mucho el aire y el aire nos hace daño a todos. No importa raza, ni color de piel, ni nada. El chiste es que el aire está muy contaminado.
He's saying what really concerns him is air pollution, because it's something that harms everyone. It doesn't matter your race or the color of your skin, and that the air is already really contaminated, and he doesn't want it to get worse. And so there is, there is a point there. If you look at state data on air pollution, on air emissions, the oil and gas industry produces about 20% of the particulate matter, produced by all stationary sources in the state. That doesn't include mobile sources like any trains or trucks that transport the material. But of course, figuring out how much of that is because of fracking that's already occurring, that's really difficult to know. That's just the oil and gas industry in general. It's also been really difficult to pin down whether fracking chemicals have contaminated water sources. That's also a really big concern. That's partly because fracking chemicals are typically proprietary. However, there was a recent state water board report that did report that some chemicals from well stimulation techniques have mingled with groundwater sources in California. Although that report is short on details about where, which chemicals, and whether they're from fracking or other well stimulation techniques.
And not everyone's opposed to this document, right?
Absolutely. There were people who showed up at this meeting who think that, this document really is dependable and that it shows that oil and gas production can be done responsibly. And after all, oil and gas, that whole petroleum industry is a huge part of the economy, and it provides lots of jobs in an otherwise not that economically stable a county. And so, there are a lot of regulations that oversee the oil and gas industry, and, workers really feel that it's doing what it can to mitigate lingering impacts. So one of the people who also spoke there at this meeting was Lorelei Oviatt, and I caught up with her after the meeting. She's the director of planning and natural resources for Kern County. She says protecting the environment is a huge priority, and that's why her county enforces a lot of environmental requirements on every well they permit.
It is comprehensive. It includes air mitigation that they've never had to pay before. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars on each well just for the air mitigation. Why would an oil industry do that? Because in California, they do have their backs up against a wall. So they want to be well regulated because they can't move the oil.
She also points out that while Kern County is the biggest oil and gas producer in the state, it's also the state's biggest producer of electricity from both solar and wind. According to state data, it produces about a fifth of the state's electricity from solar power and just over half of the state's electricity from wind. Although it's also important to note that those sources, even though they're renewable, they are not without their environmental impacts as well.
Going back to the document, you mentioned that its contents were not the only issue on people's minds at the meeting. What else did attendees tell you?
Yeah, this was also a really big point mentioned by lots of people. And it's that, people really felt like they were not being heard by the BLM. One thing is that this meeting was not on the public record, which meant that nothing was being recorded. The government went to the trouble of putting on these meetings, but they were not recorded as part of any official process. Officials like Gabe Garcia and others for the BLM had said that they'd provide a computer for submitting comments online, but they didn't, the day of, because there was apparently a lack of internet service in county buildings. Also, there was no Spanish interpreter. The only interpretation service was for American Sign Language. And Garcia had told me it's basically a slippery slope to start offering interpretation for some languages, but not others. There were a lot of Spanish speakers at this event, however, and, so they were very unhappy about that lack of interpretation. And so, I also got to speak with Naimin Martinez. She's the director of the Central California Environmental Justice Network, and she was one of a few organizations who organized a busload of people, literally, to come attend this meeting. And here's what she thought about all of this.
We're, very upset with all this situation because, it just continue doing the things that they want the way they want, and that's why not only us but many organizations like the Center for Biological Diversity that have lawyers are already getting ready to file a lawsuit if that's what is needed.
But these organizations all came up with a plan, at least to solve the problem of the meeting not being on the public record. They hired a court reporter to transcribe the meeting, which will then allow them to enter each comment in writing.
Some people were thinking it was pointless and a waste of time. So for us, you know, one way in, you know, kind of flipping the coin was like, okay, you're not going to do it, we're going to do it.
And so Gabe Garcia, when I asked him why this meeting would not be on the public record, he said that apparently the BLM has gotten in trouble in the past when they have transcribed meetings, that apparently there have been complaints that comments have been mischaracterized. So he says that generally in California, BLM meetings are not on the record. And so they're just basically meetings, not hearings. And I wanted to know Gabe Garcia's response to this sentiment that so many residents were sharing, that they just felt like they weren't being heard.
Whether or not you agree with them, I mean, do you at least understand kind of their complaints? And it wasn't just to me. I mean, you know, a lot of people voiced these concerns when they stood up as well in the meeting.
So, yeah, I think, you know, there's people, they're used to different setups. They're used to some of the counties and others that have a different protocol. And so, you know, I can see where they're coming from that perspective. But I think, you know, from our perspective, I think we want to make sure that we're capturing, you know, their comments in their entirety and really capturing what they mean. And so, you know, that's why we're stressing that you put your comments in writing for us so that we have those for the record.
And so it sounds like he's saying that they want comments submitted electronically, you know, in writing, but then it almost doesn't matter if people show up to voice their concerns in this public meeting.
I mean, Garcia would disagree with that. He says, of course, it matters anytime that the government has an opportunity to interact with the public, that that's a good thing. But of course, lots of people feel that that's not enough, especially given that so many folks don't have easy internet access and that there are many, you know, there's a language barrier in a lot of places here in this valley to submitting comments in English.
And now you're going to talk to an expert who wasn't at the meeting, but knows a lot about hydraulic fracturing.
That's right. Now I want to scope out and talk more about hydraulic fracturing itself. That's why I've reached out to one of the country's preeminent fracking experts, Mark Zoback, a geophysicist at Stanford University who directs the Stanford National Gas Initiative and co-directs the Stanford Center for Induced and Triggered Seismicity. He's published hundreds of scientific papers, dozens of which focus on hydraulic fracturing, and he's speaking to me today from his office on campus. Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning.
So let's jump right in. So hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is a well stimulation technique to help extract oil and gas from the ground. Why is fracking necessary and how does it work?
Well, fracking's been around for about 70 years or so, and it's used to produce more oil or gas from formations that have low permeability, in which it's hard for the natural gas and the oil to flow naturally. So you pressurize a section of a well and you induce a sort of a planar hydraulic fracture that propagates away from the well. You inject sand, typically, and then when you stop the pumping and the fracture tries to close, the sand kind of wedges it open, and therefore it makes it easier, a larger area for the oil and gas to flow into on its way to the well.
Okay, so now I want to unpack what's known and not known about the impacts of fracking. So let's start with induced seismicity, which a listener named Karen wrote to me. She's particularly concerned about. You know, there's been a tremendous uptick in seismic activity in Oklahoma near the oil fields where fracking is happening. What is the connection between fracking and earthquakes?
Well, there is a connection, and I'll get to that in a minute. I might point out that 95% of the earthquakes that occurred in Oklahoma were not related to hydraulic fracturing. They were related to the injection of produced water, that is, water that gets produced out of the reservoir along with the oil, and then the reinjection of that water at greater depth. That process is what caused most of the earthquakes, the great majority of earthquakes in Oklahoma. However, it is true that today hydraulic fracturing activities are responsible for earthquakes in Oklahoma. They're occurring also in West Texas, a place called the Delaware Basin, southwestern Texas. There have been reported instances in Ohio, a number of instances in Canada. So there are places where hydraulic fracturing has caused earthquakes, which are large enough in some cases to be felt. In no case have any of the earthquakes caused injury or caused damage, and none of the earthquakes in North America have ever been big enough to have caused problems. But they are noteworthy, and we want them not to occur. And so on average in Oklahoma, Texas, Canada, 2-4% of the wells that are hydraulically fractured have earthquakes that potentially could be felt. Smaller number have earthquakes that actually have been felt.
Interesting. So the majority of these earthquakes, associated with oil and gas activity, they're more associated with wastewater reinjection, but there have been a few that have been associated with fracking as well.
That's especially true in the case of Oklahoma, and it's generally true throughout the central and eastern United States. But there are now, a number of well-documented instances in which hydraulic fracturing itself has triggered seismicity.
Well, and even if the majority of them are associated with wastewater reinjection, that's a separate process from fracking, but it's kind of a necessary accompaniment to fracking, right? I mean, why can't we kind of draw a straight line with fracking for the majority of these cases?
It is in some cases. It isn't in others. For example, in Oklahoma, the fracking was really quite almost unrelated to the wastewater injection. The reason the wastewater injection was occurring is because at the time oil was $100 a barrel, and some very enterprising companies went into oil reservoirs that had been known about for decades but produced so much water they were always uneconomical. So what they did is they drilled some fit purpose large diameter wells so that when they drilled a producing well, they could handle the water that was produced, and they injected that at greater depth, and it's that process that induced the earthquakes. So in that case, hydraulic fracturing was really pretty much unrelated to the earthquakes. In other cases, you're correct. It's the flowback water after hydraulic fracturing occurs, the water that comes out of the ground after you've done the hydraulic fracturing, about on average about 25% of the injected water comes back. And when it comes back, it's very salty and picks up other chemicals in the shales. And that has to be injected. And in a number of cases, Youngstown, Ohio, Guy, Arkansas, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport area, that the earthquakes in those cases are related to the flowback water that's injected after hydraulic fracturing. The reason it's important to make a distinction is that flowback water need not be injected. It can be recycled. There's not that much of it. The produced water, on the other hand, the water, for example, in the case of Oklahoma, is so voluminous it has to be injected. So, that's a case in which the hydraulic fracturing problem could be resolved by recycling the water, but in the case of produced water, it could not be resolved. There's just too much water to recycle.
And so most of these earthquakes so far that have been documented, they're either too small to be felt or just barely felt. As you said, there hasn't been any documented destruction from them. But of course, California is highly seismically active. I mean, induced seismicity, is this something we should be concerned about in this state?
Well, seismicity is something we should be concerned about in the state, earthquakes in general. They're much more prone in some areas than others, of course. Most of the Central Valley, of course, is relatively aseismic, but there have been earthquakes in the areas where oil is being produced on the west side, mostly due to natural geologic processes. The way to kind of connect these issues, we do live in earthquake country. Hydraulic fracturing has the potential to trigger earthquakes. Is to be proactive. Earthquakes occur on faults, and what we need to do is assure ourselves that there are no faults that are going to be intersected by the wells that will be drilled, and also that there's sufficient monitoring. That what is used right now in Oklahoma, Alberta, Ohio, many places where earthquakes have been triggered by fracking are stoplight systems. In other words, you deploy a special purpose seismic network immediately in the vicinity of the wells that are being hydraulically fractured. And if you start to detect activity, the green light turns yellow or the green light turns red. So you basically stop the process before perhaps a potentially damaging earthquake occurs. And these work pretty well. But the two steps are, first, you need to try to avoid the faults, which can be done by mapping the faults very carefully with seismic techniques using what's called reflection seismology, which is kind of like a sonogram of the subsurface, maps out the formations. You look for the faults, and if they're there, you avoid them. And then you deploy these fit-to-purpose seismic networks, which are, you know, there to detect even the smallest event that might be associated with the hydraulic fracturing process.
Very interesting. Okay, well, we don't have that much time left, but I want to touch upon other environmental impacts. A lot of residents here, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, have really expressed concern about local impacts in their communities to either groundwater or air quality. What can you tell me about what's been documented in terms of, you know, the risks and how those risks are perhaps being mitigated, you know, where fracking activity is taking place?
Well, you know, When fracking activities are going on, or when drilling is going on, it's like a large construction project, and you know, with many, many vehicles, many big, many small, and so there are, you know, traffic issues, there are air quality issues, and you know, a number of states have taken action. You know, Colorado sort of led the way with air quality issues for the you know, equipment that's actually operating at the site to try to minimize that, and so those are real issues, but they can be addressed through appropriate regulations and enforcement. You know, that you just want to sort of minimize those impacts. There's nothing unique about hydraulic fracturing in the case of air pollution, traffic, noise. Just think of it as a large scale industrial process, and you know everyone recognizes that they're necessary, but they don't want it to be happening next door. And if it is, you want to be you know, certain that the proper, you know, the steps are taken to sort of mitigate its impact on local residents. With respect to water issues, the real issue is not hydraulic fracturing. The real issue is drilling the well and making sure the well is drilled properly, steel casing is put in properly, that casing is cemented properly. And when well construction is done right, the possibility of contamination is very, very low. In fact, you know, both President Obama and EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, toward the end of the Obama administration, pointed out that after millions, literally millions of hydraulic fracturing operations in the central and eastern U.S., not a single case had been documented in which the fracking process was the source of contamination. Now, there is contamination, and the cases in which there is contamination, it was always caused by poor well construction, whether you hydraulically fracture the well or not. So, yes, there are possibilities for contamination. There are possibilities for accidents. Things get spilled at the surface and so on. However, you know, all the attention is paid on fracking, but it's actually the well construction part of it that's the source of the problems and the place to put our attention and make sure things are done properly to prevent the problems.
So, you know, taking all these risks into account and taking what has been documented so far, I mean, can fracking be done responsibly?
Well, I think fracking has been done responsibly. I think it's hard for the public to recognize that hundreds of thousands of wells have been drilled in just the last, you know, a little bit more than a decade, almost a decade and a half, since about 2005, when this, you know, dramatic increase in activity has occurred. You know, hundreds of thousands wells have been drilled, and the wells, you know, have had, you know, in early days there were a few hydraulic fractures per well. Now there can be 40 or 50 hydraulic fractures per well. So literally millions and millions of wells have been drilled without serious incident. So that doesn't mean, you know, it's not without potential problems, but you have to recognize what the problems are. You have to have appropriate regulations. You have to enforce those regulations, and you have to assure that that best practice is being followed. And when that is the case, problems are avoided. And so there's nothing, you know, new about any of all this. And sort of fracking has almost kind of gotten, you know, undue attention. The oil and gas industry has been around for a long time, and sort of the no fracking, you know, mantra focuses, you know, everyone's criticism on that activity, when in fact, you know, they're upset about the oil and gas industry in general, and in cases not without good reason. But one should recognize that, you know, we're just talking about an industrial process here. Food processing is an industrial process. Transportation, flying in airplanes, you know, all of these things are complex processes, but they can be done safely, but they have to be done right. And hydraulic fracturing fracturing. Drilling and hydraulic fracturing are no different than that. They have to be done right if they're going to be done safely. We know how to do it right, and we just have to be conscientious about that.
Okay. I've been speaking with Mark Zoback, a geophysicist at Stanford University. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Sure.